It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a new unexpected ingredient you can use in your cooking, flowers.
Before that, we're talking about a new study on poverty published in the journal Science.
The study found that poverty takes so much mental energy that those under its influence actually apparently have a measurable drop in their IQ. One of the study's authors went so far as to compare being poor to pulling an all-nighter every single night.
So we're speaking about that study now with Anand Imani, an economist at CAGE at the University of Warwick, and she's one of the co-authors of the study. Hello, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well,
glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, what questions were you out to answer when you designed the study?
As economists, we do think a lot about poverty, as do many other people. And we noticed that there is a lot of research which shows things like people who are poor are, you know, not as attentive parents. They are not as effective in keeping up with preventive health care regimens. They mismanage their time. You know, they're late for appointments, et cetera, et cetera. And finances, of course. And the question that we wondered about is that all of these behaviors, is it a cause or is it a consequence of poverty? That was sort of the background which sort of got us into this research. And the specific hypothesis that we wanted to test was, is the very fact of being in a state of financial stress, you know, worried about how you're going to meet the bills next week or next month, you know, what happens when people lose a job, is the financial stress that comes with having to juggle your expenses and manage on a tight budget, does that cause some kind of a brain drain? Does that sap your mental energy so much that you have less attention available to attend to other tasks which may not be your immediate worry, but which nevertheless are quite important?
Now, it sounds like you talked to people both in India and in the United States. Who did you work with for the study?
So we, in New Jersey, we did the study in a mall. So that was one of our experiments, if I may use that word. And in India, we worked with sugarcane farmers in South India. So those were the two sets of people whom we based our results on.
Now, you were talking about how, you know, there's this set of assumptions that sometimes gets made about the poor, that
yes.
they don't work hard enough, that they
yes.
make bad decisions because they're just not focused. And sometimes
yes.
these conclusions are used to form the basis for social policy.
Mm-hmm.
What does your experiment shed light on there in terms of where these decisions come from?
Yeah, so what our paper does, and it's the first paper to show directly that poverty actually causes IQ to drop. With the sugarcane farmers, for instance, we show that the same person, right before the sugarcane harvest, when he's very short on money and therefore financially more stressed, he does worse on IQ tests than he does after harvest, a few weeks after harvest, when he gets the entire year's income and is then flushed with money. So we're saying that the very state of the financial stress because of poverty causes IQ to drop, in the New Jersey Mall study, for instance, roughly by about 13 IQ points. Now, what does that number mean? That's like going from the IQ of a normal adult to something of a chronic alcoholic. So if you, you know, descend into chronic alcoholism, that's how much your IQ drops by. Or it's like going from the IQ of an average 45-year-old to an average 60-year-old. Or by comparing with other studies, it's like losing a full night of sleep, and that's an immediate impact. I should mention that in the New Jersey study, this impact is coming just by getting people to think of a hypothetical scenario where they have some kind of car trouble. And basically what we find there is that when we say to people, well, what if this car repair costs $200? What would you do? Would you pay it in full and attend to it? Would you take a loan? Or would you, defer the problem and just keep going? And while they're thinking about it, we give them these IQ tests. And what we find is when the money is amount involved is small, it's just $200, then people, whether they're rich or poor, do just as well on the IQ tests. But when we change the amount to $2,000, just thinking about this hypothetical scenario makes only the poor people then do much worse. And that's where we see this 13-point drop in the IQ that I'm talking about.
So
triggering that thought in the shoppers in the mall makes them do, makes them worry about their own financial situation, and the poor do much worse.
So that is really striking. I want to make sure I understand you. So you're saying if you ask the poor a question about money, if it's this amount that they know, you know, it's a huge amount of money to them, $1,000, their IQ will drop. But if you asked a person who was not worried about money that same question about that same $1,000, they do okay. Their IQ does not drop.
That's right. And when the money is small, when it's $200, you know, relatively small, then even the poor do just as well as people who are rich. There's no difference in their performance.
So I guess what happens is some sort of stress effect kicks in and people's cognitive function declines.
That's right. So people are suddenly preoccupied with their own worries when we present them this hypothetical scenario, and that's that stress, they're not able to then focus on doing the IQ test just as effectively.
And can they bounce back from a dip in IQ like that? How does that work?
So, if I go by the what I find with the sugarcane farmers, absolutely, right? Because what we find is that the same person, we do the studies both about 6 weeks before the harvest and again 6 weeks after the harvest, the same person who does much worse before harvest does much better right after it. And we know, because we collected data, this is not driven by them having a lack of food. This is not driven by the effort of harvest, because we had some farmers who, when we interviewed them for the first time, had already finished their harvest, but they hadn't got the money. And these farmers who had finished all the physical effort of having to get things done for the harvest did just as badly when they didn't have the money before, and the same people did much better. They bounced back up after the harvest when they had money. So yes, it is possible to bounce back up, and people do. So it's not something about the innate attribute of a person. It's about how much mental focus they can garner at a certain time, which when they're financially stressed is harder to do.
So we've always had incredible, heated debates about how to handle poverty, both in America and in the world at large. What should this study tell us about how to think about policy as we're crafting it and in dealing with poverty?
So I think the one thing, important thing that we take away message from this study is that when people are in a state of poverty, it's not just that they have less money, it's also that it diminishes their mental capacity. So I think that being just cognizant of that changes, A, how we perceive poor people, and the reasons why they, seem to not get their act together sometimes. And the second thing it says in terms of policy design is that when we design policies to help the poor, it would be much more effective in getting them out of where they are if it would keep in mind that we don't want to load them cognitively. So what do I mean by that? So for instance, a lot of us are automatically enrolled into, say, pension plans. If the default option were such that a poor person is enrolled into a program and has to, take active effort to enroll out of it, that means much more people are likely to automatically be able to save without having to, sort of actively exert mental effort on a daily or a weekly or a monthly basis to do that. This is, so that's one implication of that.
So make the policies
easier.
For example,
a lot of other programs have a lot of, long forms that need to be filled for people to demonstrate eligibility, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a very interesting study with U.S. data which shows that high school students who come from poor backgrounds, if somebody gives them help filling a financial aid application form, they are, almost 40% more likely to apply for financial aid and then go on to college. So when you're mentally preoccupied, things that can take off the mental load because of these other factors can make a big difference in terms of how poor people handle their lives. And the same kind of, text reminders about taking medicines at the right time, for instance, could help somebody who is stressed and preoccupied mentally because of it to manage his health much better.
So it sounds like you're advocating making things easier and just more user-friendly for people who are in poverty. But what about something as simple as more compassion?
Oh, I think that more compassion is absolutely, something on the table. It's not necessary. With my first point, if people appreciate that maybe the other people who are poor are the people who are poor are not as different from them you know, the state of poverty is what is causing them to be, for instance, less attentive parents. And frankly, you know, you and I, if we, for instance, have a time deadline at work and we are suddenly very short of time, just as a poor person may be short of money, we do tend even then to neglect our children a little bit, you know, or eat less healthy. So in some ways, I think the compassion comes from realizing that any person, when he's under stress, be it from time or money, tends to focus only on the immediate fire or immediate task that he needs or she needs to do, and neglect other things which are not urgent but potentially important. Now, you and I have deadlines some of the time. If you're very poor, then you're sort of putting out these fires much more frequently. So I think the compassion comes from recognizing that we don't behave very differently when we are scarce on other dimensions. I think that's, so the compassion dimension comes from that. And to the extent that providing these kind of little help and nudges can help poor people attend to matters which are important but not urgent, and will make them more effective, I think just that will also change compassion for them, because then the taxpayer sees that whatever dollars are put into anti-poverty programs will actually have a bigger impact. And then everybody feels good about, providing that taxpayer money for the poor.
All right. Well, Anandi, thank you so much for coming on and talking about that today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Anandi Mani, an economist at CAGE at the University of Warwick. She is one of the co-authors of the poverty study we were just discussing.
Next, we're talking to one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, in our Food Friday segment, Cooking with Flowers. What?
Yep, it's true, and we'll be talking about it next. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's Food Friday here on Central Time, and today we're talking about something a little bit out of the ordinary today with WPR classical music host and in-house foodie, Lori Skelton.
That would be Cooking with Flowers. Lori found a great cookbook called Cooking with Flowers, Savory and Sweet Recipes with Rose Petals, Lilacs, Lavender, and Other Edible Flowers. She experimented, and she's here to tell us about it. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome to, welcome. It's good to be back, I should say.
What, apart from the book, what grabbed you about the idea of cooking with flowers?
Well, I've had things like stuffed squash blossoms. I've had nasturtiums scattered on top of a salad. I've certainly had cupcakes that were decorated with candied rose petals or candied violets. But then you open up this book, and while this is written by Mish Bacher of Molly B. Sweets in New York, and she's used to making some amazing wedding cakes with flowers. Mm. She's used to making chocolate bars with flowers. But she also has in here things like add sunflower petals to chickpea salad or put them in your carrot cake.
Wow.
And this is opening up a whole lot of things I never thought about that flowers could do. For one thing, she's not just working with roses or violets or elderflowers, the things you kind of automatically gravitate to. She's got recipes in here for nasturtiums and daylilies, and you can do more with orchids than just drop them in your drink. You can do interesting salads with them as well.
It's interesting because my knee-jerk reaction whenever people talk about eating flowers is that I feel really bad. I feel like flowers are our friends. They're beautiful. I don't want to eat them. But then I thought, well, they're in tea, and this is, you know, pretty commonplace there, and I don't feel guilt-ridden when I drink a glass of floral tea. And it does look incredibly beautiful. You're looking at the cookbook now, and there's something that is just really gorgeous about cooking with these flowers. What do flowers do to the flavor of food?
Well, you have a very good start when you talk about tea, because a lot of these recipes will start out with make a decoction or steep the flowers in boiling water and then do something with it. You've had marshmallows, right?
Marshmallows?
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you like a rose-flavored marshmallow?
I guess so. Sure. That sounds good.
And that actually starts off with rose petal tea. You have, for centuries, been using flowers as medicine. Now, here's a way to take your medicine and give it a little extra oomph in your diet. One thing that we discovered today, one of the things that I brought in actually comes from Troyer's in Loganville, Wisconsin. They actually made earlier this spring dandelion jam.
Oh.
And it's a very pale color, and we just served it on crackers for people to, can you guess what the ingredient is? And one person noted that, yes, it does have a floral quality. It has a very subtle green quality to it. And we started thinking about, are there any recipes where your main ingredient might lose some of that greenness or that earthiness in cooking? Add something like, say, a drizzle of dandelion jam to the top of a pea soup, and you're suddenly putting back that green, fresh element. Somebody said she could see using a flour jam in place of, say, balsamic vinegar, if you want to brighten the taste of your food, but not necessarily have it be sharp or bitter.
Or glazing, like a piece of meat, maybe.
Glazing would be great. And, of course, glazing not only meat, but glazing something sweet as well. A drizzle of, say, chamomile syrup on top of a muffin.
Oh.
And speaking of syrups, I put up Misha Bakker's basic recipe for a flour syrup. 2 cups of petals, a couple of cups of water, half a cup of sugar, and all of a sudden you've got a syrup that you can drizzle on your pancakes or over ice cream or maybe mix into a flute of Prosecco or mix with your gin. It's a real easy way to get started. And right now, hibiscus is available. You can get dry hibiscus in tea all the time. So even if that's not at the market, that'll be an easy one to grab.
Oh, yeah. Hibiscus is a really hot tea flavor right now.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of that, and it's beautiful, and it's got that red color.
And what she's got in here for hibiscus that I really want to try is using dried hibiscus flowers with cayenne pepper and make your own caramel sauce flavored with hibiscus and chili. And serve that over ice cream. But she also says use your hibiscus tea for popsicles. It's a great way to be a grown-up and still have something to cool down in weather like we've got today. Mm.
I got to try some of the dandelion jam, and I thought I'd use it anywhere I used honey. It was kind of reminding me of a clover honey or something like that. What I didn't get to try was the other thing you made. I heard about it. By the time I went to try it, it was gone.
Well,
it's all gone. What was the other dish? And describe it in detail so I know what I missed.
This is something that I think a lot of people, again, have seen a nasturtium petal or a couple of flowers tossed into their salads. I love nasturtiums. I have them in my garden. If ever I have a BLT that I know has substandard bacon on it, I will grab some of the leaves, which are peppery and sharp, and I'll throw that into my BLT along with the lettuce to snark that up a bit. Nasturtium petals have a pepperiness to them, but it's not as sharp. And so we mixed nasturtium petals in with just basic goat cheese and spread that on crackers. What everybody who tasted it found was, okay, yes, there's heat. Yes, there's a pepper flavor to it, but it's not something that goes straight up your nose and then blocks out every other flavor. This was heat that lingered in the back of your mouth and sort of sank into your tongue.
Sort of like arugula or something, a little peppery or more so?
Actually, a little bit less than arugula. And here was a suggestion somebody came up with that they thought it would be a great accompaniment, not just for a cracker, but maybe drizzled over asparagus. Or this is the one I really want to try. Goat cheese, peppery nasturtium petals, and grilled peaches.
Oh, you can bring that in anytime.
Yeah.
We'll help you sample that. Yeah, I can't remember what nasturtiums look like, though. Are they a common flower? I'm blanking on exactly a nasturtium. What does it look like?
Nasturtiums are very delicate looking. They have generally five petals that will open wide over their or around their central stamen. Generally, various shades of orange. I have a couple of yellow and a couple of pink ones in my garden. Very delicate looking, but they've got that lovely peppery flavor. You can use these for jam, and this would be a perfect thing to glaze meat with. This would be phenomenal on pork.
Lori, in our last minute, I am probably speaking for a lot of listeners. I'm not sure that I'm convinced that I should start cooking with flowers. Give me and anyone else who's on the fence here a pep talk. Why try flowers?
Because if you are getting used to cooking with herbs like basil or rosemary or thyme, this, you can think of flowers the same way you think of herbs. You've got a different element to add dimension, to add complexity, but because it's not a huge ingredient, you're not adding a lot of weight. So I keep coming back to that sunflower petals in your carrot cake. If you want a carrot cake that's got more flavor, but you already know that that batter is pretty stiff, you don't want to be doing too much to add to it. So here is a perfect example.
Sounds gorgeous. And you're eating a little bit of the sun. I like that sunflower idea. Well, Lori, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it. And it was lovely trying that bit of jelly. Hopefully people go to our Facebook page and try out the syrup you mentioned, too. We're talking to Lori Skelton, Wisconsin Public Radio's classical music host and one of WPR's in-house foodies as well. Coming up Monday on Central Time, it's a special Labor Day edition. We'll find out about age discrimination facing aging baby boomers, making it hard to get back to work after losing a job.
We'll also talk about a growing challenge for working class Americans, job uncertainty making it harder to make big life decisions, things like getting married, having kids.
And our guest will make the case that we should talk about philosophy at the dinner table.
That's coming up Monday, Labor Day, a live show on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll listen to my interview with Ira Glass, host of This American Life. He's speaking at the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield, Wisconsin, this Saturday night. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This American Life host, Ira Glass, is scheduled to talk at Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield tomorrow night. And the Big Top was hit hard by a thunderstorm last night, but the show is still on.
If you've listened to This American Life, you know that it's personal. Sometimes it winds its way through places you didn't know it was going to go.
Well, we interviewed Ira Glass last week, and that's pretty much what happened. We went unexpected places, but in the end, it was so much fun and so Ira Glass that we decided to air even the chit-chatty stuff at the beginning that technically wasn't supposed to air.
So, here's Ira Glass talking about Bayfield.
I haven't been to Bayfield. I've been around Wisconsin a bunch.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of Illinois people vacation up there. Now you're in New York, but it is actually really gorgeous.
Are you a Wisconsin native?
I am. Can you tell?
Yes.
I also like cheese.
Me too, though. Honestly, I feel Wisconsin has everything, I have to say. Yeah, yeah. And House on the Rock, of course. When you go to House on the Rock and you go to that Frank Lloyd Wright house that's right nearby, it makes Frank Lloyd Wright seem like a small-minded little troll. No, I'm serious. Like, I feel like it really puts him in perspective.
Well, he was definitely the House on the Rock dude, had a vision, and he went for it.
I know this is a rude question to ask, but is this the interview happening right now?
No,
or is
it's
this
not.
The pre-interview part. Oh, it's not. Oh, this is good, this part. Yeah. I hope you're taping this part.
I'm just trying to make sure if you're worthy of our interview time.
No,
I'm
noted.
Okay. Anyway.
So did I pass?
You passed. I think we'll proceed.
Okay.
You can appear on the airwaves of Wisconsin Public Radio, which, of course, you already do.
No, one last I feel like note. I already had my audition. This is the longest 14-year audition in the history of.
And you passed with flying colors.
The Ideas
Congratulations.
Network. Are we on the Ideas Network?
Yeah, it's going to be on the Ideas Network. This is a new show called Central Time. So you're, I guess you're one of our biggest. I don't know. Do you like the word star? That's what we might call you.
I
we've had
the
on.
Word get. I'm one of your biggest gets.
Okay, you're one of our biggest gets. And one last note.
Are you serious? You're not going to use this part? This part is so nice.
I don't know. Maybe we'll use it. Galen, the producer, is nodding and giving me a thumbs up.
Wait, and who's been the number two biggest get besides me? Or maybe I'm number two, but like, who else has been another big get?
We had Sanjay Gupta. Does he count? Who else did we have,
sure.
Galen?
We had, what's his name, The Lion King.
Oh, we had the guy who played Mufasa on The Lion King on Broadway and got to meet Michael Jackson, Nate
No,
Stampy.
And I'm against The Lion King on Broadway.
Oh, see, I gotta disagree with you.
Are you serious? Why, who did you relate to in The Lion King?
Who didn't like, I relate to in The Lion King?
Are you serious? I felt like I sat through that whole thing thinking, like, who is this for? Like, there's nobody to relate to. Like, oh, I'm really supposed to relate to the story of some, like, you know, some person whose dad was the king and died, and now I'm supposed to be the king. Like, what's where's the emotional entrance in that?
Well,
like,
you do know it's Hamlet for Disney, right? And who doesn't relate to Hamlet? It's every man.
It's interesting you say that, because I think I have the same problem with Hamlet. I think Hamlet is a bad play.
Okay, well, that's our problem then.
No. I'm not even joking. Like, I think it's an interesting play. Like, I think it's an interesting play, but I don't think it's fun to watch. Like, I don't feel like you get caught up in the characters. I don't.
I think the average,
like I feel like it's a hard to relate to story where you just feel like, I think as a modern viewer, you just think like, well, dude killed your dad and is sleeping with your mom. Don't go home. like, stay away.
What about like, honor? What about family honor? What about indecision? That's something that plagues all of us. Maybe not you, but the whole thing is about Hamlet waffling back and forth. And should he? Can he? Will he? I think that's compelling.
Again, find it hard to relate to. I mean, we don't have to agree on this. I'm just saying, like, it's not an emotional experience either of those plays for me. I guess I'm trying to think of some sort of thought that could actually make this broadcastable. And the thought that I'm having is the plot of Hamlet or of The Lion King, I don't think could be on an episode of This American Life, because there's no one to relate to. Like, they're not good enough for our show. No, I mean, I say that, I'm being facetious, but do you know what I mean? Like they're not right for our show, because I feel like we're looking for stories that are more emotional than either of those stories. And emotional specifically, and like you could relate to somebody and you feel really strongly when you watch it or listen to it.
Don't you think that Hamlet and The Lion King are both writ large, though? I mean, The Lion King is a spectacle. And what they're really getting at is ambivalent father-son relationships. And I think about a piece that I heard on This American Life, Sarah Vowell talking about her dad and her problematic relationship with him and how they disagreed about everything. And he wanted to cancel out her Democratic vote with his Republican vote. And yet when she thought about him dying, you know, she ended with a line something like, "I wanted to hurt." I think that's the same thing that Hamlet is.
I think that the ambivalent father relationship in Hamlet is just very different, and it doesn't play out in as relatable way. When the play opens, his dad's a ghost wandering around and showing up at banquets and stuff, and he doesn't have a relatable ambivalence about his dad. He knows how he feels about his dad. He feels loyal to him and wants to avenge him, perhaps. But that's different than what Sarah's going through, where her dad is driving her crazy, but she also loves him, which is the thing that most of us feel about our parents, whether or not we had a dad.
Now, I was just watching an interview you did for Slate, and you talked about your parents and how they, sounds like they hated your idea of going into public radio.
Yeah, yeah. Was your mom into you going into public radio?
My mom's the reason I'm in public radio.
Oh, is that true?
Oh, yeah. It was on. It's still on 24/7 in her house at any given moment.
Wow.
If I walked in, it would be on right now. Whether or not she's doing other things, whether or not she's home, it would be on.
And so do you have the sense of like, oh, well, then I'm going to go on the radio because I'll get her attention?
No, actually, it just seemed like a place that felt comfortable and a place where I could express sort of who I am and write. I wanted to write, too. What about you?
I mean, I think we're talking about, first of all, we're talking across a generational divide, because when I was a kid, public radio didn't exist in the way it does now. Like, I grew up, I'm 54, and so I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and public radio didn't start to exist as a national network until the early 70s. And at the point where I got a job at NPR in Washington in 1978, like, I had never heard NPR on the air. Like, I walked in the door never having heard it. And most people hadn't heard it. And so it wasn't a thing that like your parents could be playing around the house. And unless they were listening to kind of one of the old land grant stations. And you know, like Wisconsin Public Radio probably existed before NPR existed, but it was, you know, local shows and statewide shows. And so the things that we think of now as being public radio really didn't exist and the identity of it didn't exist. It was just a much different thing. And then my parents were very much against me doing it because they just felt like you're never going to make any money, you know, and they felt like and they didn't get it. Like they would listen to public radio and they just didn't get what was good about it. And so for me, I think if they had been hardcore public radio listeners, I was such a contrarian child, I would not have gone into public radio. And one of the things that made it possible for me to go into public radio was the fact that it was a place that I knew they would never, ever hear me. And then, I mean, that sounds like I'm joking, but I think it's completely true. Like the fact that they didn't listen was an added bonus to the whole thing. So I could do my thing by myself without their surveillance. And then when I got older, when I got into my 30s, like, I was ready to be closer to them. And they really did oppose me doing public radio. And when I started This American Life, they tried to be good parents and they would try to be encouraging, you know, and they wished for me the best. But they made very clear, like, that they thought it was a mistake. And I remember the first year we were on the air, we won this award that I don't think many people have heard of, but it's kind of a big deal in our world, which is the Peabody Award. So it is this big broadcasting award, and we all went to New York City, and there was a ceremony at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, and it was very fancy, and fancy people were there, and like famous people, like Lily Tomlin got an award that year, and The Simpsons got an award, and like Tom Brokaw or Peter Jennings or somebody was the host of the thing and would give you your award, and we got this award for This American Life, like our very first year on the air. My dad was at the table, and I remember we were there, and I remember him saying to Nancy Updike, she reminded me of this recently, one of our producers, during this ceremony, he said to her, like, I still don't see why he's doing this with his life.
Oh, no, that can't be true now. Surely by now.
No, they came around. No, they totally came around. No, they came around. It's funny, like enough of their friends heard the radio show over time. That they came around, and truthfully, like in the early years, they used to have them on the show all the time, and so then they kind of came around on the show, and I think my dad even kind of came around on listening to NPR. Like I think he'll even turn on Morning Edition now, even knowing that I won't be on that show. Like for a while, their entire public radio listening was simply things that I was on, and then if it was an episode of the show that I wasn't in much, they wouldn't like it. But they're like, well, that was okay, but there wasn't enough of you. And then but I think they've kind of come around. I remember specifically that like our fifth year on the air, I did some promotion for the show, and I went on to the David Letterman show, and I had never been on television before, and it was after that my parents said officially, it's okay if you don't go to med school.
So it was the Letterman seal of honor. It sounds like you're probably one of the only people in the country who went into public radio as a form of rebellion.
It's very sad, but true. Yeah, that's really true.
Is This American Life? I mean, it's not a rebellious show, but you did bust up the format a little bit, and that format has changed the landscape of public radio. I know when I hear you interviewed, you don't always, you know, take a lot of credit for the way public radio has changed, but I mean, surely you can hear that public radio sounds different now, and I think that's in part due to This American Life.
I think it sounds different in small ways around the margins, like on the weekends, on the stations that take The Moth and Radiolab and stuff like that. I feel like you can hear little things, Snap Judgment. But I think, you know, the news shows pretty much are on their own course, and we've had no influence on them at all. Fresh Air continues apace without any influence from us. Garrison Keillor's show seems to do just fine without being influenced by us. I think when you look at the programs that people actually listen to in large numbers, we've had no effect.
I'm going to say yes and no to that. I think you're right, but I also think that if you listen closely and you listen to the way stories reported now, it will be reported in this deliberately conversational style that is intended to sound like a person talking to you instead of a person reading to you from copy. I hear that.
I mean, you hear that? I feel like I wish I heard that more. Is the truth. Like, I like that style. So, I wish I heard it more. I mean, that, like, you know, there were always reporters who did that. It's not like we invented that on our show. Like, there were always really chatty sounding people on the air on NPR. And then there were people who were stiffs a little bit more, like very good reporters, but kind of stiffs in the way they would perform. And so that was always there, you know, like one of the first hosts of All Things Considered was this woman, Susan Stamberg, who was like the chattiest performer ever.
Coming up, the rest of this interview with Ira Glass of This American Life. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
We're going to continue listening now to our conversation with This American Life host, Ira Glass.
I'm curious about how close you get to the people who tell these stories.
I mean, for the stories where it seems like you're getting to know a lot of personal stuff, like in some cases, you know, it's that will be somebody who one of the reporters or I will have spent days with or longer. Though some incredibly intensely personal stuff comes out, and just sometimes in these stories, which are just somebody comes in the studio, sits down for an hour, and then they tell some amazingly personal story, and then we, you know, I say thanks so much, and you know, we never speak again. Like that happens all the time.
How does that feel?
I would be a better person if I said that it felt horrible, but in fact, I'm not that good of a person, and it feels a little weird sometimes. Like it does feel a little weird, but you know, like I'm, you know, we're making stuff every week, we're making new stuff every week, and so it's, you know, I understand that the reason why I'm talking to them is not to make them my friend, but to you know, to have them tell something to people, and they understand that too. So it can be a little weird when it's somebody who you end up spending a week or two with. Like it can be a little weird, but then, you know, like often the people who you end up spending a week or two with, like, you know, you do kind of befriend, like, and you know, you will stay, you know, I do stay in touch with, and you know, have emails every now and then, and you know, hear from.
Well, I imagine starting this show, I mean, I don't have to ask, but obviously it's changed the shape of your whole life. And Galen, our producer, we were just talking about how our show is 5 weeks old, and there's so much work to do. I don't know. And we were wondering if you felt that same way when you started This American Life in the beginning. Did you know, I don't know, do you have any sense about what it would become and what it was like in those early days?
I had no sense of what it would become. Like my goal for the show was just that it would be a nice show. And I thought, like, this is a thing that I like. Like, I like this style of stories, and I think that there's an audience for this. But it's not necessarily, like, a super big audience. And our business plan for the show was to be on something like 65 stations by the end of 2 years. And our early contracts, when we would have people sign releases, you know, if they wrote a story or something, to come on the radio, we just thought, like, well, what's the most impossible, far away? It would be crazy if we would last this long length of time, and those contracts were off for 3 years. And I remember lying in bed, like all of us just worked all the time. We worked late nights. We worked weekends. It was a staff of 4 people. And we just worked all the time. We were never not working. If we were awake, we were working or eating. And that lasted for several years. Like that lasted for a few years. And I remember I was a few years into it. I remember in the first year lying in bed one night, and the thought occurred to me, like in a way that was very visceral, where I just thought, like, wait, I signed up to do this for how long? And then I realized, like, there was no end date on it. Like, it wasn't like a tour of Afghanistan or something where, like, you know, like, oh, I'm going to do this for 6 months or a year, and then I come back. It was just sort of like, oh, I signed up to do this every week. Forever, like if it's, you know what I mean? like for the rest of my life, if it can last that long, like basically, if the show survives, I'm signing up to. And I was just like, what was I thinking? And then I asked Scott Simon, who does, you know, Weekend Edition Saturday, about this thing that you're asking me about, and I said, like, I'm in the situation where I never am not working on the show, and that's true for everybody on the show. How long is this going to last? And he didn't hesitate. And he said 5 years. It lasts 5 years.
5 years?
5 years. And he was right. It's 5 years. It lasts 5 years.
I don't know if that's encouraging or completely depressing.
Well, at least you know there's an end point.
Well, wait, what happened in 5 years that changed?
In 5 years, we had enough of an audience that it was possible to get underwriting and stations started paying for the show. We had more money and we could hire more people. And so we had another, like, two more people. And then you're in this different situation because are you weekly or daily?
We're daily.
You're daily.
We're daily, so 3 hours a day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, we're like a very different thing. But, yeah. But like, you know, for us, 5 years in, we could have reruns. You know what I mean? We had a bank of shows that we could have reruns. We had stations that were then at that point, you know, they would pay to run the show. And so we had more revenue. And basically, we could hire a couple of extra people. And it made a huge difference.
I don't know. Do you have any advice for? I mean, obviously, our shows are different animals.
I mean, the only thing you can do is amuse yourself. You know, like, that's the only thing you got going for you. Because I mean, it's not going to ever pay that much money. And the number of hours you're going to work is going to be crazy. And the main thing that will make it good is the more you're out in a very selfish way to amuse yourself, actually, the better the show will get.
I like that answer. I think we can live
weirdly,
with that.
Like, I find it weird that that's not advice that's given to, like, young journalists. Like that was always kind of my inclination, so I was going there anyway. Like, I didn't need that advice. But I feel like when I talk to journalism students, I feel like there's so much worry that they're not going to get, like, the skills and the basics and learn to be responsible and all that, that nobody tells them, like, if you have fun and follow the things that you're actually curious about, like, everything's going to get more exciting both for you and for the audience. And I feel like somehow that the most important message gets neglected.
So you've got these 500 shows behind you. And as for what's ahead, I've heard you were kicking around the idea of a This American Life musical at one point. Do you sing?
I'm not a singer. I'm not a singer in any sense that anybody would want to hear it.
So people will not hear you singing at the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield.
Well, I used to say in the promos, I can't remember if I said in the promos for it, I used to have this line of, like, unlike some other public radio hosts when they come to town, I will not sing. But now I feel like, oh, that's just too mean to Garrison, who I really adore. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seemed funny to me, but now I just feel like, oh, that's snarky. And I didn't mean it to be snarky. I just thought it was a funny thing to say. So no, there will be no singing. I have been dancing. I'm in a dance show now that starts touring in the fall. Yeah. Yeah, well, to say that I'm dancing, it's more like I'm in a show with two incredible dancers, modern dancers. This is going to sound awful as I say this, but basically I tell stories, they dance, but it's not corny. It's not like, you know, now they are the volcano and now they are the lava going down the volcano.
It's so
not
it's
like
not
that.
A it's modern not like... interpretation of The Lion King.
No, it's not. It's definitely not that, as you know. Good. My feelings about The Lion King. No, it's two dancers and I tell stories and they dance. And then occasionally, a couple times during the show, like, I dance with them. And so I've been in training for that for several months. And you know, like, I'm old. I'm in my 50s. Like, you know, that it actually took quite a doing to get to the point where I can dance on stage with people.
See, that's the problem with radio. No one can see you dancing. Well,
that is not the problem with radio. That's the entire advantage of radio.
Well, Ira, it has been completely unexpected and really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Good luck with your sixth week.
Thank you. I think I've got the dates wrong, actually. What are we, more like week 8 or something?
Well, good luck, you know, as you head into week 9 and 10. And good luck with your venture. Good luck with the next 4 years minus 10 weeks.
That was Ira Glass, host of This American Life.
And coming up, we'll hear about what's going on in our brains when we sleep and how sleep helps us live better and more creative lives.
And our next guest says the U.S. should be hands-off on Syria. We'll hear why.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.